we get a donation from Juneau, we'll match it with somebody in Juneau. If we get a donation from Bethel, we'll match it with somebody in Bethel.
Helping foster kids in Alaska through donated laptops. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 24th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, telecommunications improvements for residents of McCarthy.
The new system will provide, of course, enhanced voice calls, eliminating the echo and the delay from the satellite.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
If you're looking for ideas to help others during the holiday season, Anchorage Democrat Representative Les Guerra has an idea for you. Guerra is working with volunteers to help connect foster youth with donated laptops. Guerra says a constituent began collecting them, and now his office is helping to organize the effort.
The state used to provide computers to foster youth, and now they only provide them to you after you graduate, which is a great incentive, but a terrible way to get you through high school and junior high school without a computer.
Guerra says they now have a modest system in place to collect and distribute the donated laptops.
A computer is so important if you're going to do research for high school, for middle school, if you're going to do research to try and find a job. You know, the Department of Labor's stuff is all online. Without a computer, there's just another barrier that foster youth who already have a tough time have to clear. And so we want to at least get rid of that barrier for as many youth as we can.
He says they're trying to make it easy for people to help. Contact them if you have one to donate, and they'll do the rest.
And so if they would just call our office first at 269-0106, we'll put them in touch with one of the groups that'll get the computer to a youth who needs it.
He says they're operating on a shoestring, but they'll gladly work statewide with donations.
If we get a donation from Juneau, we'll match it with somebody in Juneau. If we get a donation from Bethel, we'll match it with somebody in Bethel. We have contacts to know who the foster youth are, and so we just need the computers. But finding the foster youth who need them will be the easy part. There are 2,000 foster youth statewide in Alaska, and I doubt we're going to run out of the need, that's for sure.
Amanda Mativier was herself once in foster care, and she now works to help youth in the system through the organization Facing Foster Care in Alaska. Mativier says foster kids tend to move quite a bit, and that makes it hard to keep up in school.
What I've seen with teens is that a lot of them have fallen so far behind that they have to take online classes and do extra work to try and catch up because they've bounced around and moved so much. So this is an opportunity for them to be able to go home after school and work on their homework or have a place to keep all their schoolwork so that they're not constantly trying to pick up the pieces.
She says having their own computer is also a way for them to stay connected to those they care about.
It's an opportunity for them to stay in contact with friends and family and then also potentially even siblings, because a lot of our youth are separated from siblings. So this is another means for them to continue that communication.
If you have a laptop you'd like to donate that is in working order and is less than 4 years old, you can find more information about how to donate it at our website, aprn.org. McCarthy is a step closer to having internet and cell phone service. Recently, the National Park Service released an environmental assessment on a proposal that would bring broadband and telecommunication services to the community. From Valdez, KCHU's Tony Gorman reports.
Copper Valley Wireless plans to connect a microwave system from its existing fiber optic cable in Chitna into McCarthy, which relies on a satellite system for its telecommunication needs. Jim Gifford is the chief operating officer for the Valdez-based company. He says the goal is to provide internet and cell phone service to the community.
The new system will provide, of course, enhanced voice calls, eliminating the echo and the delay from the satellite, and will allow high-speed data communications for McCarthy and along the road system back to Chitna.
Gilford says the project calls for the construction of two new communication sites and the improvement of another within the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve.
The sites are designed to minimize the visual impact to the park and the visitors, while still providing wide coverage along the road corridor and in the McCarthy area itself for the communication.
The facilities would be installed by helicopter at Gahina Butte and near the Lackinac River. Equipment upgrades would be made at McCarthy's present communication site at Cerrado Ridge. The Gahina Butte site would provide the microwave repeater and cell service. The Lackinac River site would serve as a repeater, which would relay the signal to Cerrado Ridge and into McCarthy. Wrangell St. Elias Senior Management Analyst Danny Rosenkranz says once the sites are installed, Copper Valley Wireless would go into a small lands lease with the park.
It would be a right-of-way to use and occupy a space about 150 by 100 feet. And in that, they would have a dish, power facilities, and communication facilities that they would access by helicopter, and it would catch the beam, and then it would move it to the next station further on.
McCarthy residents aren't the only ones benefiting from the project. Wrangell St. Elias Superintendent Meg Jensen says having the new service will improve the park's EMS services, which are not provided along McCarthy Road.
We've had some instances where there have been fairly serious accidents of not only people who live out there or park visitors, but even park employees, and there's been no way to call for help. And so we think it's really a public health and safety issue as well as a park operations issue. And for those two reasons, we really do support the proposal.
The estimated cost of the project is over $5 million. The National Park Service is taking public comments for the project's environmental assessment through January 2nd. Upon approval, the project is tentatively scheduled to begin this spring and completed by the fall. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Recently, Southeast commercial and sport fishermen were shocked by severe reductions in halibut catch limits for next year. As KDLG's Mike Mason reports, the International Pacific Halibut Commission will expand their research efforts on the groundfish if a series of proposals are approved by the commissioners at the panel's annual meeting next month.
The governing body tasked with protecting the Pacific halibut stocks will hold its annual meeting late next month in Victoria, British Columbia. The International Pacific Halibut Commission is made up of commissioners representing the U.S. and Canada, and the commission makes harvest recommendations that are then referred to the governments of the U.S. and Canada. Another responsibility of the IPHC is to do research on the halibut stocks in the North Pacific. At the interim meeting last month, staff with the commission outlined the research conducted this year and the research proposed for 2011. One of the research efforts addressed at that interim meeting was the coastwide program launched in 2009 to collect oceanographic data at each survey station using a tool called a water column profiler. Under questioning from commissioners, IPHC Executive Director Bruce Lehman remarked that the data from the profilers is used to help put together the annual halibut stock assessment.
There's two uses of it. First one is looking at water column properties and part of our ongoing thing, looking at issues such as catchability. The other thing is to further refine our understanding.
Basically, the water column profilers collect data from the over 1,000 stations that are fished to assess the halibut stocks in the North Pacific. Yet another ongoing IPHC research project involves putting video recorders on specific commercial longliners. Bruce Lehman says many captains were reluctant to allow electronic monitoring of their catch.
We didn't get as much cooperation from industry in the deployment of these things as we were expecting.
The IPHC staff is proposing four new research efforts for 2011, including the use of some different tagging technology and expanding the genetic work that has been done on the halibut stocks. Lehman says the genetic work basically expands on genetic work that has been done the past couple of years.
It looks as though there is a sex-specific marker in the genes of halibut, which is a bit unusual in fish. The way we presently do our stock assessments, we have a what we call a split-sex model. So we do the assessment on each sex separately. But in order to do to partition the catch into different sexes, we have to use it's a fairly complicated process of looking at the sex ratio of particular sizes and ages of fish on our survey, and then looking at the size and age composition of the catch and estimating the sex composition through that sort of secondary approach.
Another proposed research project is to expand the survey conducted in Area 2A off the coast of Oregon and Washington. Bruce Lehman notes that the fourth research project involves testing different baits to catch halibut as part of the annual assessment of the stock. Lehman says the standard bait used is getting expensive.
We have been using number two semi-break chum salmon since we expanded the survey in 1996. And the problem is that that is rapidly getting just far too expensive for us to use. A lot of the salmons now, which were bait quality before, are now being processed, particularly in overseas markets, for human consumption. So we need to look at something that for which we can have sort of a guarantee of supply and which will have a lower price over the long term. So we're looking at testing pollock, pink salmon, and herring against our standard chum salmon bait next year.
The proposals for new research projects will be taken up during the budget discussions at the IPHC annual meeting coming up in late January. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the history of the Salvation Army bell ringers.
He was trying to figure out how he was going to feed all these families. And he spotted a great big crab pot down on the docks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
It looks like there will be no gillnet fishery targeting king salmon returns to the Stikine and Taku rivers again this May. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced this month that the preseason forecast for both systems is too low to allow for a commercial opening. From KFSK in Petersburg, Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Petersburg Wrangell Area Management Biologist Troy Tina says the Stikine return is forecast at 30,000 kings, which leaves little room for a commercial harvest for U.S. fishermen.
At a forecast of that size, the allowable catch for the United States is only 190 fish. The 190 fish is too small to allow any directed commercial fisheries, but it does allow for liberalized sport fish regulations.
Those liberalized sport limits don't go into effect until the department puts out an announcement in the spring. This is the third consecutive year the forecast has not allowed for a commercial harvest in Southeast. Tina says a couple of problems have led to the poor returns. Those runs were spawned during years of very large escapement when lots of fish made it upriver. According to Tina, that resulted in crowded stream conditions.
The escapements from those large returns were not the best for producing future good returns, and so that's kind of what we were seeing. That was 2005, 2004, 2003. Production off those large escapements was not that good.
Also, Tina says the ocean conditions were not that good for king salmon survival. Commercial fisheries on the Stikine stocks reopened in 2005 for the first time in decades. Even with the commercial harvest that year, Tina says about 40,000 fish made it upriver to spawn. That was well above the top end of the department's escapement goal for the year, which was 28,000 fish. Tina says the runs have continued to meet escapement goals each year, except for 2009. He's optimistic for the future.
I think we are on the upward turn of things, on an upward trend here. This preseason forecast, 30,000, is significantly higher than last year's preseason forecast, 23,000.
And the actual return ended up just a few thousand fish short of that this past year, but well within escapement goals. Like the Stikine River, the forecast for the Taku River near Juneau is also too low for a commercial fishery in May, according to the department. At a preseason estimate of 41,000 fish, the U.S. would only be allowed to take just over 1,500 kings. Juneau Area Commercial Fisheries Manager Kevin Monagle says this forecast is very similar to last year's, and like last year's fishery, the department's taking a conservative approach. The department plans to produce in-season estimates of the king returns for both rivers by late May. If the numbers come in substantially higher than the preseason forecast for either system, the department says it could allow for some limited commercial fishing. When they've been open, the Stikine and Taku fisheries have provided a substantial boost for gillnetters whose regular season starts in June. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Fairbanks City and Borough Government have begun two projects to preserve old documents and mark historically significant buildings. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The city of Fairbanks recently was awarded a $6,000 federal grant to start an ambitious project to preserve documents that tell the story of the Golden Heart City since its founding 107 years ago. Deputy City Clerk Debbie Osterby says the Preservation Assistance Grant from the Endowment for the Humanities will be used to bring in an expert consultant to take a look at all the city's documents and artifacts just to get a sense of what's there and what needs to be done to protect them.
The records are voluminous. They're 107 years of historical records. Dating back to the original incorporation documents.
Osterby says state law requires city clerks to preserve historic documents and to make them available to the public. The documents provide a wealth of historic information that is invaluable to researchers, archivists, historians, even genealogists, to name a few. The city's document preservation project is intended to protect all the documents and artifacts from the ravages of time and handling. City officials hope to make the collection available to the public within a few years.
That's part of our plan, part of our dream, is that we would actually identify a room right here in City Hall. We would turn it into a library where, of course, it is adjusted for light sensitivities, air quality, so that the documents are preserved in that manner, but make these items available to the public.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough also is working on a historic preservation project, in this case, historically significant buildings. Officials with the borough's Commission on Historic Preservation last month installed interpretive signs at 11 buildings around town. Those include the Patty House, the Mary Lee Davis Alaska Heritage House, the Episcopal Church, and the Northward Building. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Alaska Department of Transportation is looking at a stretch of the park's highway between Denali State Park and Nenana that would be widened for passing lanes. The project is currently in the public comment phase, and the DOT is looking for input from residents and businesses along the 140-mile stretch of road under consideration. From Talkeetna, KTNA's Sue Dio has more.
The DOT is currently looking at a passing lane project that examines 140 miles along the George Parks Highway between Denali State Park and Nenana. Construction on the highway would most likely occur in 2012. Albert Beck is the engineering manager in charge of collecting comments. He says that a field visit was performed this summer along the park's highway to see what areas needed passing lanes. He says although DOT is looking at 15 different areas for passing lanes, not all will be chosen due to funding.
The idea is if any additional money became available, that we would have done enough of our preliminary engineering so we could construct more locations. But it's anticipated we'd only be able to construct 6 to 7 at this time. The specific design constraints at each location will govern how much each location will cost, and then how much we can build within the existing budget.
He currently has a $14 million budget for design and construction. The roadway between milepost 163 and milepost 298 is being considered. Each of the 15 sections is 2 miles in length. He says specifically a number of comments have been received by residents living 10 miles south of the Denali National Park entrance.
We've received a lot of public comment in that area, and I don't expect that location to make the final list. Though we haven't completed our public comment period, that location has received a lot of negative comments.
He says something for that area could be planned for the future, but the numerous comments from the area are being taken into consideration, and he'll move on to other areas that aren't so populated. For motorists that noticed the very visible changes near Willow along the park's highway this summer, Beck says his project scope is different.
For my project, it's basically 150 feet from the center line of the roadway. And for just documenting the impacts in the environmental document, I show that we would be clearing up to the right-of-way line. That would give us enough room to make the design decision whether we're going to actually clear that much.
There's a special DOT website set up for residents and agencies that want to follow the process. Comments are due December 1st. Residents can expect a decision on which areas may be chosen for improvement in January. I'm Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
It's a ubiquitous part of the holiday season, the Salvation Army bell ringers. KMXT's Maggie Wall rang bells at a Kodiak store earlier this week and decided to do a bit of research into the practice.
A friend of mine says she likes to ring the bells for the Salvation Army at Christmas because, one, it doesn't cost anything, and it's nice to not have to write a check for one more thing during the holiday season. And two, it takes just a few hours, and while time is definitely short during the holidays, the donation raised from bell ringing makes such a big difference for those who benefit from it. The Salvation Army's John Quinn is seriously busy these days. After consulting his packed schedule, we agreed to meet ever so briefly at the Harborside Flyby coffee shop, where he was multitasking, visiting a friend while waiting to meet with me. Quinn says the bell ringing tradition began in San Francisco in the late 1890s during a dock workers' strike.
When a Captain Joe McPhee, Salvation Army officer, they were having a dock workers' strike, and he was trying to figure out how he was going to feed all these families. And he spotted a great big crab pot down on the docks and convinced the operator of the big crane to lower it over for him, and they actually would just tell everybody keep the pot boiling, and they would bring in cans of this and cans of that and dump it in and have a mulligan stew of whatever came out and fed the families through the strike. And the next year he decided, you know, that worked pretty well, and so he had some small pots made and hung them on tripods and rang a bell.
So the phrase, keep the pot stirred, changed from a literal meaning to a figurative one as people contributed whatever pocket money they could to help feed others. Now, more than 100 years later, on a wet, windswept island in the North Pacific, the bell ringing is a vital part of the local Salvation Army's Christmas effort. Local bell ringing fills the gaps and makes Christmas a little bit merrier for less fortunate Kodiak residents.
It pays for the food that we buy. We get a lot of turkeys donated that go into that, but we buy a lot of them too. And then all the other foodstuffs that go into it. And the toys, and a lot of them get donated, but again, we go purchase. And that Christmas ringing on the kettles, for the most part, pays for us to be able to help others at Christmas.
In Kodiak, bell ringers stand at Safeway and Walmart. Traditionally, this last week before Christmas is the biggest giving days for the campaign.
It's because of the timing. This is the last few days before Christmas. Yesterday when you were ringing was the last Monday that we'll be ringing this season. And so during that last days, you always see people's generosity. It's almost over. I got to make sure I put something in before the season's out. And many people who've been waiting all season for that time make very generous donations.
So it's kind of like, oh, I'll get to it. I better get to it.
Right. In today's world that we live in, there are so many of them that live on plastic. And you'll hear a lot of them as they're coming past. We don't carry cash anymore. But when they swipe the card, then they, okay, I want some cash back. And that goes into the kettle on the way back out the door.
The Salvation Army's John Quinn. I'm Maggie Wall.
From temples to churches to the office, the holidays bring out the better angels of our nature. We open our cupboards to give food. We buy toys for tots. And we buy gifts for one another. In this commentary, veteran Alaska journalist Rhonda McBride looks at the spirit of giving and how to keep it alive throughout the year.
We have so many reasons to be cross these days. Cell phones, emails, text messages, the constant crackling of communication that passes for intimacy. but with so few sparks of authenticity. Not like the aunt who has sent you a birthday card every year since you were old enough to know it was your birthday. Not like the waitress at the diner who serves up your meal with a smile at the end of a long day, or the postal worker who greets those people who put off holiday shopping and mailing with an air of helpfulness instead of the censure you know you deserve, or the jewelry store clerk who treats your small $10 purchase as if you were buying a diamond ring. This year at my workplace, we went through a lot of technological change. Getting adjusted to it made a lot of us cranky, but there was one coworker for whom no question was too stupid, no question that didn't eventually get a patient answer. If you have someone like this in your workplace, you know why this guy is the angel at the top of my tree. And when I look back at the twinkling lights that wrap around it, I'm reminded of the random acts of kindness that brighten my year, especially from strangers. The kindness of strangers is what we celebrate on Christmas, whether it's the stranger who drops money in a Salvation Army bucket in hopes of helping someone he or she will never know, or the stranger who offered a pregnant woman, Mary, a manger to give birth to a boy who changed the world. I wish there could be more of what I like to call Christmas people, people who spread good cheer all the year round, people who can be counted on to be kind to everyone, no matter how extraordinary, no matter how ordinary. They do it so naturally, with a grace of muscle memory that tells you that it truly is a part of who they are. To be more like them, huh? To light the wick of the human heart with a flame that jumps from person to person. Earlier, I didn't mean to sound so bah humbug about the internet, because we had a great example this week of its power when a fifth grade teacher in Quinnahawk set a chain of events in motion with a video on YouTube to the music of the Hallelujah Chorus. The humble backdrop of a village, so in tune with the spirit of Christmas. I don't know how many emails I've had from friends and relatives sending me this link. So now, we are all linked to something greater and bigger than ourselves. Blessings to you and yours. I'm Rhonda McBride.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tony Gorman in Valdez, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Maggie Wall in Kodiak, and commentary by Rhonda McBride in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. From all of us here at APRN, have a wonderful holiday weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.